from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It's the 31st day of January 2019. I'm Todd Gleason out of the office today. A very special program for you, something that I've not ever aired in its entirety anywhere before, from 1995, an interview that I did with Norman Borlaug, the 1970 Nobel Prize winner, the father of the Green Revolution. In the 1960s, India was starving, and Borlaug found a dwarf variety of wheat that saved that population and much of Asia. I asked him, to begin with, what he told the Nobel Prize Committee during his acceptance speech.
The acceptance was that we had won a temporary, we'd won a battle. We hadn't won the war. And that unless we were able to maintain over a continuing long period of time the right balance between food production, distribution, equitable distribution, and population growth, and all of the other basic necessities for a decent life, this would be an ephemeral thing. It would evaporate. And I said that for the next 25 years, till the turn of the century, I could see our ability to produce the food we needed. The problem of equitably distributing was more difficult because of poverty, a lack of purchasing power by a large number of people in the world. But that's essentially what I told them. We'd won a battle. We hadn't won the war, and there was no winning this. It was a continuing struggle until we brought into better harmony our ability to produce and distribute the food that was needed to improve the standard of living of the hungry and miserable, of which there's a vast number of individuals, especially in developing nations. We have them too in our low-income sectors of some of our large cities, but we have means, at least with food stamps and other devices, of at least assuring that they're not in the same straits as we have in the developing countries, when the governments don't have the wherewithal, even if they wanted to do something about the hunger and poverty.
You won the Peace Prize in 1970.
Yes, sir.
25 years later, coming up on the time frame that you predicted, we would have problems again if we did not do something. Describe to me what you see as the problems in two areas. Begin with production and where we are now as to where we were in 1970, and then move to distribution.
Well, I have seen great improvement in the countries that were in the worst situation in the middle 60s. And it so happens that some of those countries is where they are the largest concentration of population. India, Pakistan, Indonesia in the case of rice, and China. Their agriculture has improved tremendously. But the problems of the 60s today are in the African countries south of the Sahara, where the situation is growing progressively worse. The per capita food production without all of the difficulties of distribution is less now than it was 25 years ago. Population is still growing rapidly, and agricultural production is near stagnant, and it's worse and worse every year. But I think I can see some hope in a couple of those countries if we can convince people in key places that chemical fertilizer is food for plants, not something that's polluting the environment like it can become when enormous quantities of animal manures and chemical fertilizer are overused or improperly used. But we have no fertilizer in the African countries, or very little. And yet, these ill-advised, poorly informed voices are what is the biggest roadblock to changing the agriculture of Central Africa.
Whose voices?
The extremists in the environmental movement, through their influence on agencies such as the World Bank and various other organizations, including USAID. It's probably less ruinous now than it was 3 or 4 years ago, but it's still adversely affecting development in those countries.
What is the Green Revolution as you define it?
Well, first let me say that the term, I didn't coin the term. What happened was this, in the wheat technology that was developed in Mexico, which changed dramatically the production of wheat yields and production in Mexico in the 50s and 60s, in the crisis of the late 60s and 70s, was transplanted into the real hunger problem areas of South Asia. And it wasn't done blindly, because in the early 1960, I traveled briefly for a couple of months with the Rockefeller Foundation, who had sponsored the program in Mexico for those previous 20 years, and FAO, looking at all of the problems in agriculture in North Africa, the Near East, and South Asia, Middle Asia, as far as India. And I saw things where I thought that some of this technology on wheat might fit. But the biggest need for was young, well-trained scientists, not just in theory, but how to integrate, put the pieces together across disciplines. And I made a report to FAO and to the Rockefeller Foundation suggesting that we established a hands-on training program in Mexico, where I had or was in the process of turning over the responsibilities for that program to a young Mexican scientist that we had trained. And FAO would pick the best young graduates from their universities across those countries. The foundation, I suggested, should finance it. They would stay with us 6 months to a year, and I would be involved in training them in all of the disciplines that bear on crop production, in this case, wheat, namely in genetics and plant breeding, agronomy and soils, plant pathology, control of weeds, as best it could, in the general economic policies behind what was needed to get production moving. And I suggested we start an international nursery to be grown by those students and any other scientists in those developing countries. And that part of the training exercise would be to grow those plots of the different wheats from different countries under quarantine after disinfecting in Mexico, make them into uniform nurseries, send them through FAO, and have them grown widely. And I think the first year we grew these at 25 locations in the Near and Middle East as well as in Mexico. Soon it was all across Latin America, into Canada, US, as far as India, at 125 locations. This told us from reading those data when they came back, these Mexican wheats, because of the way they were selected, were unique in their breadth of adaptation, in their spectrum of resistance to stem rust especially, which is the most destructive disease of wheat. And then with the food crisis on in Pakistan and India, especially, Ford Foundation And Rockefeller got involved, and we started this cooperative program with the two governments. First with Pakistan. Pakistan made the tough decisions before India, mostly because of President General Ayub, who was a farmer at heart. And it started growing very rapidly, and they sent more people to Mexico, young scientists. India didn't want to in the beginning. They said, we have lots of trained scientists. We don't think it's necessary, until Pakistan got going. Then they began to send them. They did have better, more well-trained scientists, trained mostly in UK universities, some of them in the US, some in Canada and Australia. But they were working, when they went back home, they were working on very narrow issues that were not much related except in a very indirect way to producing more food. And until we got this all changed, then it took off.
So you won the Nobel Prize for Peace because you taught nations how to raise wheat. And you were able to adapt wheat to those nations.
The story behind it was that peace is linked to the first basic need, food. Without food, you don't live very long. And more generally, also, you're pretty rebellious against the whole system that permitted you to fall into this situation. And this is the way the committee looked at it. And of course, the changes in production were dramatic. And they're a continuing thing. It's not a one-event deal. For example, India was producing 11 million metric tons a year in the 1965 when we introduced this technology on wheat from Mexico, adjusting the package to fit the local conditions. Today this year they harvested 65 million, from 11 to 65 million. Pakistan from about 2.5, this year 17 million. Many other countries, not of that magnitude, but important changes. China used part of this, and certain Latin American countries, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and so on. But it's a continuing process. Once you get the research programs hooked up to the extension programs and the farmers, this can be and has to be an ongoing, continuing process, because look what we're doing. During my lifetime, I'm 81 years old. When I was born, world population was approximately 1.6 billion people. Today, we are 5.7 billion, and we are adding another billion every 10 years. That's what I said we have won when I received the Nobel Prize. We have won a battle to buy time, to tame the population monster, as I've always called it. Because this massive population growth overwhelms the developing nations especially. Because, for example, in our own society, at time of independence, we were an agricultural nation like the Central African countries are today. 98% of our people were on a little piece of land. Today we're less than 2%. That migration over the 200 years, a little more, to industrial opportunities, commercial challenges and opportunities, all different walks of life, is possible because our agricultural system has been very efficient. But the way the Green Revolution said, for the first time, it looks like something is happening in a dramatic way on wheat production in India and especially Pakistan. And now it seems the new rices are catching on. A green revolution seems to be forming and taking place. And so the cliche was born and used sometimes to our detrimental effect because it seemed to convey the idea that everything was rosy, everything is solved, and it's a battle, it's not the war.
Who coined the phrase again?
The director, administrator of USAID, Dr. William Gaud, G-A-U-D, 1968.
Again, we're listening to an interview that I did in 1995 with Norman Borlaug. He at the time was 81 years old and has since passed. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970.
You talked a bit about fertilizers and chemicals. Tell me the good and the bad that you see in them.
Well, in the case of fertilizer, it's the plant's food. Just like what we eat three times a day to sustain our body. And you have to have the right mix. If you aren't, and the utopians today would like to have us say, oh, if you just use the organic fertilizers, you don't need chemical fertilizer. The plant doesn't know the difference between chemical fertilizer from a nitrogen standpoint or from the organic plant when it decomposes and releases that nitrogen. This is all in the imagination of some poorly informed people that have entirely too much influence and that have done a great disservice to the hungry, miserable peoples of the world. The truth is, when you talk, and you should never mix fertilizer and toxic, let's say, insecticides or fungicides. They're of different order of magnitude completely. They're different kinds of compounds. But even when you're talking about those compounds, we should remember that there are many toxic compounds, some of which are carcinogenic when you test them in the ordinary way with high concentrations in the feed rations on white rats that are highly inbred so that we get nice figures in our charts. But those compounds have always been there, but we don't happen to eat them in sufficient doses to have any great adverse effect. The hydrazines in the edible mushroom is a good case in point. Extract that, increase the dosage, put it in feed for rats, and it's a beautiful carcinogen. But all of this comes back, a lot of this fallacy, to the sensitivity of chemical analysis today. The zero has disappeared, essentially. 50 years ago, when you could analyze for one part for 250,000, or at best one part per 500,000 of the chemical, that was wonderfully efficient chemical analysis. Today, it's one part per quadrillion. That zero doesn't exist. But that one part per trillion is of such insignificance that it should not be played up. But this is the way we are. And we live longer than any previous generation. At the turn of the century, the life expectancy at birth here in the USA was about 65 years for a boy baby, 67 for a girl baby, the average of the two sexes, 66. Today it's about 72 and a half for a boy baby and close to 79 and a half for a girl baby. And it's extending. But in all species, including the human species, there's a biological time clock built into that that sets the upper limit on longevity. Now, there's quite a great variation. There's no immortality, even though we keep searching for it. And in that second, when each and every one of us is conceived, we draw a genetic hand of cards. And our longevity, barring accidents, will in a large part be determined by that genetic hand of cards that we drew from daddy and mother, grandparents and great-grandparents, and so on back for a long period of time. And it's chance. Now, what percentage of the potential that's in that genetic hand of cards we will realize in real life will depend on good nutrition, exercise, sleep, whether we destroy our health with too much hard drugs or alcohol or could be any other toxic substance. But that will determine the real part of that life expectancy that we inherit at that point in time, barring accident. An accident, of course, terminates that life expectancy in that particular moment. But this is why there's so much confusion, and especially in agriculture. Today we're in this country, we're a society of urban large metropolises. And it's my personal experience, and I've seen it happen in my own family. The second generation living in urban America or Western Europe is equally bad, has no concept of the complexities of agriculture. The abundance of food is taken for granted, and the cheapness of food as expressed as percentage of our take-home pay. There's no country in the world that's ever had food of such great variation, different types, at such a low percentage of our take-home pay as the United States does. And yet, the general public gets the impression we're being poisoned out of existence. It's completely erroneous. I guess what this means is that we would like to see happen is that we use that genetic hand of cards we drew, we eat a balanced diet, we get plenty of rest, we get proper exercise so that we can die young as late as possible. Is that what the game is about? Because how many people do we see today with Alzheimer's? Is that what we want? I don't want to die that way. I prefer to die with my boots on, doing something that I think is useful.
I'm done.
I just have one question. You said in 1970, we bought you all some time. Have the other people lived up to their part of the contract?
No. I said that those of us in agriculture also have an additional responsibility to convey to the leaders of fellow scientists, educators, and religious leaders that to continue to say that indefinitely we can produce all of the food that's needed. This is putting to one side the problems of equitable distribution, which is tremendously complicated because of the poverty of so much of the world population. But there will come a point in time when we push people off into and destroy the habitat. We talk now about the tropical rainforest. We'll be pushing them off into all different kinds of parts of the world that shouldn't be in agriculture, that should be left for the indirect benefits of forestry, watershed protection, wildlife habitat, outdoor recreation, so on. And it's my belief that we should use high yield, modern agriculture in those areas best suited for agriculture and leave in so far as possible these other areas as undisturbed as possible for other uses. Let me put it this way. If we take the case of our own 17 most important food, feed, and fiber crops that are grown in the U.S. at the present time. In 1940, we produced 252 million tons of harvest. And by 1980, we had produced nearly 600 million tons. If we had tried to produce those 600 million tons of 1980 with the technology of 1940, we would have had to have cultivated an additional 450 million acres more land of the same quality. We didn't have that quality of land of that magnitude. So we would have been out chopping down most of our forest, 70% of our forest, a lot of it on rolling land and the erosion, or plowing up our pasture land and rangeland and the wind erosion that would have been the consequence. What about the wildlife habitat? What about opportunities for outdoor recreation? What about watershed protection and the flooding and all of these silting into reservoirs? All of this is part of what proper application of high-yield agricultural production technology has brought to the standard of living of the American people and of the developed nations in general. But most people don't appreciate it. They take it all for granted. Why? Why? Jefferson talked about this, you know. He used to be very interested in history of bygone civilization. And long after, shortly before he left office, the office of the presidency, looking at, and he was very proud of the Louisiana Purchase and what it had brought to, in wealth to the new nation. But he was fearful also because of the ups and downs of past civilization. And here's one quote that I like very much. And he said, ease and security, E-A-S-E, are these the drugs that had baited the eternal challenge in the minds of men? And did nations, like individuals, when they were well fed and bodily comfortable, become lethargic and complacent? But to me, one of the great frustrations, after I have worked outside the U.S. for 51 years, is to come back to a university town, and I've spent time in quite a few of them, short periods, but I've been teaching for one semester each year for 10 years at Texas A&M. And I'm not pointing a finger at Texas, but I think it's general. You talk to the people in the streets in any of these cities, and they haven't the vaguest concept of the magnitude of the problem of producing the food and distributing it equitably. And what that means to world security. You aren't going to build peace on empty stomachs and human misery. And that was what the Nobel Committee said in 1970 when I was given Nobel Prize for peace, or through the window of peace, for contributions to food production in the countries of South Asia especially.
I interviewed Dr. Norman Borlaug in 1995. He won the Nobel Peace Prize and is considered the father of the Green Revolution. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media, a very special edition, as I'm out of the office this afternoon. Do visit our website. The address there is willag.org.